You're listening to The Pulse, where it's all about student news, student opinions and student voices.
Hello, welcome to your Monday Pulse. I'm your host, Eleanor, and today I'm joined by Colin and Tamara. And also we're joined by Zoe McKenzie, who is our current SU Equal Ops and Welfare Officer. We've got some interesting topics coming up on the show today, some quite heavy topics. We're going to be talking about suicide, just as a warning for anyone who's listening. We're going to start by talking to Zoe about Suicide Awareness Week. So this is a campaign taking place across the university this week in order to raise awareness about the prevalence of suicide at university and encourage the university to take action. So I just want to start by asking you, Zoe, this is the first time that the Student Union have recognised Suicide Awareness Week. So what led you to organise it and what are the main events that are taking place?
So this is something that I wanted to do when I became an officer, is do more to recognise the issue of student suicide, because it is quite a big issue. Miles, who is a student, came to me a couple of months ago and said, this is a huge issue, can we work together on it? And so out of that, this week was kind of born. We've got loads of social media going on this week, which is one of the main things that we've got, because it reaches so many people. But we've also got a display of 95 pairs of shoes on the Portland steps, which represents the 95 student lives lost to suicide last year. And on Friday at 12, we're also doing 95 seconds of silence to again represent the 95 student lives lost to suicide last year. And we're going to be doing speeches, and different people are going to be speaking about their experiences. So yeah, those are the main things we've got on this week.
Okay, so that sounds like a really kind of tangible way to visualise those 95 lives. So is that lives across the country, across universities across the country?
Yeah, that's England and Wales last year.
Okay, so as well, alongside this, you've released a petition for the university. So that's outlining what you want the university to undertake action-wise to prevent student suicide.
Yeah.
So I noticed like a number of the points were concentrated on around raising awareness, and obviously the week is about awareness. So do you think this issue is more about awareness or about action? And do you think the university are reluctant to take action? What do you think, what's the main goal here?
Okay, so the campaign has two different aims. One, which is to raise awareness of suicide as an issue and to be able to signpost students to different services they can use. But the second part of it, which in some ways is one of the most important parts, is for the university to take notice of the fact that students think this is such a big issue and to actually take action, because this is such a huge issue. Students are losing their lives and the university is not investing properly in its welfare services. It's increasing student numbers year on year and not increasing the funding for welfare services. The wait time for the counselling service is literally the longest that it's ever been, and no one seems to be doing anything about it. So we're working hard to make sure that the welfare services here are suited for students' needs.
Okay, great. So it's a mixture of awareness and funding. Okay.
Yeah,
I think that's does seem to be a major issue, is levels of funding for these services, because they are so overstretched.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask is, I know kind of mental health and suicide are very much an intersectional issue, as in there's a lot of groups that struggle with mental illness are also more marginalised in other ways, such as LGBT groups. So what do you think the university can do to address those particular element of the problem?
I think something that came up when I was running to be an officer last year is having specific counsellors that really understand the issues that certain groups of students face. So having like LGBT plus counsellors, having BME counsellors who really understand, as I said, the issues. If you don't trust your counsellor, you're not likely to open up to them about what's going on in your life. So having a more diverse set of people running the welfare services and being available for students, I think, would help. I think awareness raising in general is useful, but actually it's not our... we are not the ones who need to be working out how to solve this issue. We're just there to say to the university, this is an issue, you can do something about this, why haven't you done something?
Definitely. I think, as you were saying before, we were talking about how peer support can only go so far in mental health, and I think this is a great start to catalyse kind of a conversation between students about mental health, but as you say, then it's you know, university action is needed as well. And then the kind of final question would be, I know many students struggle once they've actually left university in terms of a lot of the services available do then disappear.
Yeah.
Do you think that can be included into this conversation at all? Or, you know,
I think part of what I've discussed in various meetings with the university is linking up the different services. So something that I'd really like to see is more of a relationship between the local NHS services and our services here on campus, so that when you're coming to university and then again when you leave university, you have more of a transition from one to the other rather than stopping your support that you maybe previously had and having to start like fresh when you get here. And that the same is true for when you leave university.
Right, yeah, no, definitely. And Miles has just joined us. Miles Smith, who's just been elected Equal Ops and Welfare Officer for 2019 to 2020. So congratulations, Miles. So just since you joined us, wanted to ask, in terms of this issue, kind of suicide, mental health, and why do you think it is such a big issue among students particularly at the moment?
I think that sort of could be explained. I think that could be explained sort of across a national context. It's not just an issue affecting students here at University of Nottingham, but it's something that's affecting students across the UK. But not only that, it's actually a growing case in terms of all people of this age, not just students here or students in general. So in terms of it being a growing concern, it's something that we need to tackle, not just only in universities, but outside of universities as well, and opening up the conversation about mental health and suicide awareness. So, yeah, university is a good starting point, but hopefully it's something that could sort of have a domino effect on opening the conversation to sort of the wider communities.
Yeah, definitely. So this week is kind of a catalyst for the conversation, 100%. So is there anything you guys want to say to students, like how they can get involved, like particularly?
Yeah, so I guess the main thing is to please sign our petition, which we're going to be presenting to the university at the end of this week. We're aiming for 3,400 signatures. At the moment, we have 1,000, which is a really great start, but we need as many as possible, so please sign it.
Okay, so sign it, share it on Facebook, yeah. Post it everywhere. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, anything else?
Also on Friday, we are doing 95 seconds of silence on the Portland steps to remember the 95 student lives lost to suicide last year. So if you're free, please come and join us, because we want to show the university how much this issue means to all of us.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Sarah and Miles, and good luck with the campaign. I think it's
thank
a really
you.
Great cause. So, hello and welcome back to The Pulse. I'm joined today by Colin, Tom, Tamara, Zoe and Miles. We've got a big panel today. And next up, we're going to have a story from Tamara about Love Island star Mike.
So unfortunately, Love Island star Mike Thalassiotis was found dead, age 26, on Friday. The cause has been ruled as suicide, and a lot of other stars have paid tribute to him. For example, Montana Brown, who described about how she had a conversation with him a couple of days before, and his fellow Celebs Go Dating star Sam Thompson paid tribute to him on Instagram. But this has also led to a conversation about how Love Island can and how reality TV can treat the stars once they are done with the show, because according to a lot of the stars, they receive support whilst on the show, but then once they leave the show, despite all the things that could have happened on the show, for example, such as things that happened to Mike on the show, which led to him having a name afterwards, how this can lead to public perception of them. For example, other Love Island star Marlon Anderson spoke about how she received no support, only flowers after her both her mum and her baby died earlier, I think in the last year. So I wanted to ask everyone, do you think it's the responsibility of shows like Love Island to consistently have support for the stars, or once they leave the show, is it their responsibility to get support themselves?
I think with these type of shows, if you are putting people in a situation where there's going to be enormous strains on their mental health, and you're also to an extent exploiting that person for commercial gain, even if they choose to be involved. So I think the show 100% then has a responsibility afterwards to make sure that they're cared for physically, mentally, etc. I think there's definitely a problem of kind of not wanting to talk about these things, because then you have to admit that these shows are problematic and that they can cause issues. So, but I definitely think they have responsibility.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the voiceovers and things like that on shows like Love Island really play into the public perception of what these people are like. So if you are making kind of stereotypes about people and giving them a name in some ways, then it is your responsibility if then that takes a toll on their mental health.
My understanding is that in this particular case, obviously there was Sophie Graydon last year. His mum, he was the sole care of his mother, and she died recently, and he's also dealing with the death of another friend. But it's also, I think, Love Island's responsibility to provide kind of care for stuff which isn't just Love Island related. So when it came to the death of Marlon's child, all she kind of received was flowers. So it shouldn't, the focus just shouldn't be on their responsibility because of like the show's effects, but they should probably be taking care of these people, which are effectively just made them money for you know, God knows how long, in the same way that an employee would be taken care of by a business or likewise.
I think it's sort of an important point that you raise about sort of the token effort of flowers and things like that, and how they made sort of these big companies a lot of money. But it's sort of reflective of what does happen here at university, because at the end of the day, each student's worth like £9,000 a university a year. And so it's, as you were saying, if an employer were to have that same situation in a business, how would they take care of their sort of people? And it's what we need to sort of employ and put into this university. We're paying so much money to come here and strive to be part of an establishment, but where's the aftercare and support for people like us? And often what happens is that people on pedestals are usually like dehumanized, and we don't sort of look at them as people. And that's reflective of like your popular student or your student who does sport, or sort of like a front and standing point of like their peer groups. Often people see them as these happy, popular, giddy people, but what's happening underneath we don't pay too much attention to. And by not destigmatizing things like mental health, it actually has like a catastrophic effect in a sense, because those individuals find it hard then to come forward, because when they do come forward, either they're not listened to or their opinions aren't valid or rejected by the wider community. So it's so important to destigmatize sort of mental health and suicide, and allow people to know that it's okay to not be okay, if that makes sense.
I think it's indicative, isn't it? We started this show looking at the situation in the university, and I think it's the same problem in wider society. I think we pick on the entertainment industry because it's got a particularly bad track record in this. You have to look at the sort of Disney stable and, you know, the sort of child stars do you think we put an unnecessary amount of pressure on the entertainment industry? Do we expect them to maybe go further because they're using the image of these people in their reality shows?
What I think is interesting is, I think a lot of people, you know, and this is probably one of my first responses, was that there are situations in which people are presented quite awfully on reality TV. But you also have examples of when people act quite poorly. I mean, Roxanne Pallett, is that her name? The woman, Celebrity Big Brother, who accused Ryan Thomas of hitting her. But when we, the audience, could see that he hadn't hit her, and she was making a complete mountain of, you know, out of a molehill, and the rest of the house were turning on him and saying he's basically tantamount to a domestic abuser. I can't imagine she got, I mean, I know for a fact she got an awful reaction when she came out of the house. Does the reality TV show then have a responsibility to, even when someone has behaved quite poorly, to protect them because of the outside kind of reaction it would get, and, you know, how much that would destabilise anyone's mental health, even if, you know, you've done something wrong? Does it mean that you should, by society, be recognised as a bad person?
I think a lot of reality TV shows can be seen as perpetrators of, like, not, like, treating the people who go on their shows very well. Like, the whole Ryan Thomas incident, so many people on Twitter were complaining because they were saying, how is, like, Big Brother actually doing this to him? And they're leaving him in a house, and he was visibly getting more and more upset when this was happening. And then even on Love Island itself, like this year, there was with Danny Dyer, when the boys went to the other house, and they'd kind of left her to sort of obviously think the worst of Jack. But then it was like you could see that it was like visibly making her more and more upset. And then, I mean, Ofsted received so many complaints because of that. And I think it's awful that that's sort of being allowed to happen on reality TV shows, but then it kind of also shows sort of what's happening afterwards with them not giving out proper care.
I mean, it started with Big Brother. I mean, some of you guys wouldn't have been around when Big Brother first started. And that was kind of, let's get a load of people together that wouldn't work in normal society together, and let's see how mad we can send them. And that's really what happened from season two. Season one, you could argue, was a fairly good social experiment. It was interesting. But from season two onwards, the idea seemed to be to drive the contestants more and more mental as the show went on. So I think the television companies have a lot to answer for, don't they?
Returning to like your original question where you're saying, do the sort of reality TV entertainment business sort of need to do more because of the position that they're putting people in? It all comes back to sort of that equality over equity argument. And it's, if they are putting people in positions where they are more vulnerable, then they ought to be doing more to support those individuals. So I do think they should be doing more. And often what happens is that people are afraid to ask for more because they feel like, if I couldn't ask for it here, then I couldn't ask for it there. And that's a trap that we sort of fall into, in that we're too nervous or too shy to be able to say to people, no, we actually do deserve more in these circumstances.
Definitely. And I think related to that, it's also the fact that if there aren't systems in place, you don't know what to ask for. And I think definitely related to what we were talking about earlier about university, a lot of people feel like they don't know how to ask for help here because what are the systems? What are or if they're underfunded. So I think like there's definitely parallels between the two worlds of actually making sure there's places people feel that they can access help.
You know, yeah, but the entertainment system industry, what that has that we don't have in the university system maybe, or the NHS, is seemingly in a bottomless pocket, unlimited funds. You know, these production companies that make these programmes are worth millions and millions and millions of pounds, and they make their money on the misery of others. So, yeah, I mean, listen to what Miles said. It's right that they should be held to a higher account, because they're in a position that they could do something about it. The NHS waiting list, there's lots of other factors as to why that takes so long. But, you know, in private industry, they could just write a cheque.
With that comment, I partially agree, partially disagree, because your NHS comparison to the entertainment industry, I fully agree with. However, your NHS to the university comparison, I disagree with. What we're made to feel is if that we don't have the budget, where that's not actually the case. And often this causes us to look into, right, can we reallocate the budget to support our services, which also, yes, is a good alternative, but we can have more of a budget and we don't need to take away from other services in order to do that. If you look at our university's investments, there's a lot of things that we could sort of take money from and reinvest into. And that's just looking at the sort of money in general that we already have circulating in the system. But from money that isn't already invested, there is a pot of money that can be reached. It's just in order to have sort of the student body as a whole, as a union per se, to sort of ask for it and make sure that it's sort of mandated upon the university to grant it.
I find that really fascinating, because I've definitely taken on the perspective, I think via kind of osmosis, by kind of half comments, that our university probably didn't have the money to really stretch for anything. Which, if you're saying that isn't the case, I think that's really, really interesting. I would be, I mean, maybe you already do this, and I haven't kind of looked for it enough. Is there some kind of way of the student union kind of regulating how much the way the university spends their money, or is that kind of very opaque? And is there a way that you can kind of formulate that and show that to students so we're kind of more aware of how our money is being spent?
The university does a thing called publications on its website, where it publishes its financial statements, so you can get them on the university website. Also, Cassie O'Gore, the education officer, did something where she put together a graph that kind of shows how your £9,000 is spent each year and what proportion goes where. I agree with Miles, though. The university wastes huge amounts of money on completely ridiculous things. The Vice Chancellor is paid more than the university annually invests in the counselling service.
Yeah, that's pretty, you know, dire. I mean, the big screen outside Portland and all the kind of flashy stuff that they send out to possible graduates. My brother's recently is going through the university application now, and the things that they're sending in that must have cost. Have you seen the little flippy?
Yeah.
I mean that it looks cool. My mum was like, can't believe how great this is. The little brother's been playing it for hours. But I mean, how much do you reckon that? Do you know how much that costs to print? Must have been absolutely fortune. Yeah.
It's kind of horrible to think about in the sense that the university will waste huge amounts of money on getting prospective students to get here, to give them their money. To give them the $9,000, and then as soon as they get here, they just don't seem to care anymore.
Yeah, I wondered what you guys think about. Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about actually lowering tuition fees. Mm. Do you guys worry about what impact that would have on mental health services, like if they're worried about funding?
It is a issue, and it is definitely something that is concerning. But, I mean, we shouldn't be paying that much for our education in the first place. So, kind of, it could have an impact, but the university is literally swimming in money. Swimming in money.
And on that point, I'd like turn your attentions to, if we look at Scotland, who don't have any fees to go to university, and Wales, who subsidise the fees, their welfare services are outstanding. So it is something that would impact us if we continue to sort of budget and prioritise how we do. However, if that's addressed and changed, then it's something that shouldn't impact us.
Definitely. Well, I think it's been really interesting to hear that perspective, guys. So thank you very much.
You're listening to The Pulse, where it's all about student news, student opinions, and student voices.